So the Federal Trade Commission, I refer to Coco for more detail on this, seems to me extremely important legislation in the corporatist development, and was considered as such, and as the analog for the ICC, Federal Reserve System, the agricultural subsidies, etc. There's also an interesting development during the Wilson administration, started during the Taft administration. This is pushing the social welfare end of the welfare corporate state. This is the Commission on Industrial Relations, the United States Commission on Industrial Relations, which was set up in late 1912 by Taft, but really it hardly got started before Wilson takes over and Wilson appoints the people and so forth. The U.S. Commission on Industrial Relations, which was stimulated by industrial violence, worker violence and what to do about it, this is the first time really on a federal scale we have this tripartite arrangement I've been referring to. Three labor representatives, three corporation representatives, all of whom incidentally were national civic federation types. The NAM was squeezed out of this arrangement. And three so-called public representatives, who are our public busybody types, social engineers. Among the public representatives was our old friend John R. Cummins, who plays an extremely important role in this whole business. Also, Mrs. J. Borden Harriman, one of the famous Harriman family, who becomes one of the, which I'll refer to a little later, either tonight or tomorrow night, one of the upper-class female social worker busybody types, which begin to proliferate in this period. The chairman of the commission was a genuine left-winger named Frank Walsh, to the left of the corporate Cummins types. He was a lawyer and social worker, and he was put on because he was supposed to be a friend of John R. Cummins. I mean, that was his cachet in this thing, so he was trusted by easily the National Civic Federation and proposed by it. And it turns out they split later on during the work of the commission. Walsh was a little too leftish for the rest of them. And Cummins puts in as the research director, head of research for the commission, Charles B. McCarthy, Wisconsin, another Wisconsin progressive. McCarthy is a very interesting guy. McCarthy was essentially a student of Cummins, student and disciple. He was the head of the Legislative Reference Bureau of Wisconsin and was engaged in many of the activities. He helped collaborate on the drafting of the Federal Trade Commission Act. He hailed Germany as a great example of planning. He called it, quote, a wonderful example of the rest of the world. And particularly the role of Bismarck and one of his great economists, or so-called economist theoreticians, Otto Wagner, one of the historical school economists. And he did his work on the Industrial Commission, he thought of the Industrial Commission as trying to bring the German model, Bismarck model, to the United States. He's one of the big figures in workman's compensation, pushing workman's compensation, pushing the whole Wisconsin idea and so forth. One of the McCarthy's lucubrations, or if I have some interest, when he was reminiscing one day, he said, quote, the backbone, in other words, of his thought on political economy, the backbone of my thought on political economy is that the state must invest in human beings in the same way as you invest in cattle on a farm. I think it's kind of cute. It sort of, I think, expresses pretty directly the progressive intellectual's outlook toward the masses out there. So, having been a long-time student and associate of Cummins, he was the research director, commissioning very in, of course, with Dumpers in the Antelope Valley. I should say, by the way, that John R. Cummins, along with his friend and ally, Selig Perlman of the University of Wisconsin, were the two great labor historians in the early part of the century. They were the not only historians of American labor unions in the United States, but the official setters down of what we call the official AFL line, the craft union, monopoly unionism kind of involvement, kind of a corporatist framework kind of position. I'll get more to that when I get more to the unions later on. Charles B. McCarthy, in addition to being a corporatist, a progressive, a Cummins associate, and everything else, also turned out to have been a friend and classmate of John D. Rockefeller Jr. at Brown University. Classmates keep popping up all the time. It's really it's incredible. It can't be a coincidence. I don't believe it. By this time, Rockefeller, I think maybe, this is kind of speculative, but maybe, I think, under the hammer of blows of Morganism, the hammer of blows of corporatism, etc., begins to adapt to the situation. And we're going to get a more of a social work progressive quote, progressive kind of approach coming in. For example, Rockefeller sets up an industrial relations department as part of a fairly newly set up Rockefeller Foundation. One of the big shots in this, by the way, was certain William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was the Rockefeller Foundation person, and somehow pops up as Prime Minister of Canada for about 50 years or something. At least when I was growing up, he was always the Prime Minister of Canada. James, and so the relationship between the Rockefeller Foundation and McCarthy was quite close. Jerome, Rockefeller in general, I guess, Jerome Green, who was a personal Rockefeller aide, writes to McCarthy in October 1914. He says that under William Lyon Mackenzie King's direction, the Rockefeller Foundation might, quote, gradually convince the public both of our disinterestedness and of our strictly scientific method, unquote. Again, you have this idea of, in a sense, the Rockefellers, okay, I'm going to turn to science too, in quotes. You know, these guys can do it, I can do it. Which I guess is the beginning of the great Rockefeller Foundation career, in a sense. I mean, the great career of finding and developing promising scholars. We now have the latest fruits of the Rockefeller interest in scholarship, of course, with Henry Kissinger, our beloved foreign policy czar. what happens is that there's a split in the commission. McCarthy is kicked out under Walsh's aegis. And we have three reports, basically. We have several reports, Commons Rights Report, and other various independent reports of the commission. One of the key people in the commission, one of the things about Commons is he becomes he promotes, and his Commons Report presages the New Deal almost line by line. He sets forth about a situation which will later become similar, very similar to later NRA, the Wagner Act, WPA, and CCC. All these things are prefigured in the Commons Report in 1915. The Industrial Commission reports are written in 1915. Commons' sidekick, the Assistant Director of Research, who was Assistant of McCarthy, is another guy who appears among our rulers from then on. An amazing number of people start around this period and continue ever since. They sort of live to the age of 110 or something, and they've only died out fairly recently. And they start with around this World War I period. One of them is Billy Leiserson, who was the labor economist, student of Commons, post-associate of McCarthy, who's pushing here state public works for depressions and state unemployment services. And he comes up with a New Deal and then during World War I and so forth and so on. One of the largest flour millers in the world at the time. And Ballard's report outlines the following steps that should be taken to cure the industrial problem and so forth. He's in favor of raising wages, various government steps to raise wages, all right? One, you should restrict immigration as a way of raising wages. Very sound, if your interest is in raising American wage rates, one of the ways to do is to keep everybody out. Two, to have a national minimum wage law to raise wages. Three, workman's compensation laws. Four, factory inspection laws, which of course impose, as we've seen with meatpacking, impose higher costs on, cartelize the system, impose higher costs on competitors, small competitors. Next, the federal 8-hour day law to make sure that those firms which are unaesthetic enough to have a 10-hour day or 12-hour day should be forced into the line by their 8-hour day competitors. The Federal Employment Service and Federal Public Works during recessions. And also, in all of this is practically the entire New Deal, not only 33-35, but really also 33-38. The whole spiel, I think, is set out in the Commons Report, the Ballard Report, etc. One of the things, kind of a cute thing, which prefigures the CCC and maybe a few other institutions in the world, it also calls for, quote, government concentration camps, where workers with a small wage would be provided, supplemented by agricultural and industrial training. And we see here the beginning of the great CCC concept of out there, you know, the great forestry army, as it was called. The whole idea of, you know, forced government labor. They used the word concentration camps those days. It had not yet been rendered inoperable. The word, not the policy.
So who runs against Wilson in 1916 after these fantastic corporate reforms have been put in? I haven't mentioned the Federal Reserve System yet because I'm going to go back for coming to that. That plus the Federal Reserve System, all these fantastic corporatist reforms have come in. Who can be found to run against this great man? Charles Evans Hughes, 1916, Wall Street lawyer, who turns up, at least after his defeat, as the attorney for Standard Oil Company in New Jersey. I cannot refrain from saying that Hughes is a Rockefeller person. Cannot stop myself from saying that. He's also a member of the same Baptist Bible class as John D. Rockefeller Jr. And he, of course, he was beaten. He almost won, but he was finally beaten. Okay. It's ensured that the Wilson-Morgan continuation of power. What's the Federal Reserve System? We'll come back to that, of course, later on. Bear with me here. The thing about the Federal Reserve System basically was it succeeded. Well, first of all, it was backed by almost every banker. I don't know. There might have been bankers that opposed it in detail, certainly, but the concept, certainly the big bankers all favored it. There were precious few people that were against it anyway, in general. I think the major reason for that is the fact that the Federal Reserve System succeeds the national banking system. The national banking system was sort of was kind of an abortion. The national banking system was a halfway house from free banking, hard money free banking, at least free banking kind of system, which we had before the Civil War, to a central bank on the other hand. In other words, we have basically what we have before the Civil War is a free banking setup, with the exception of the first and second banks of the United States. But after Jackson got rid of the second bank of the United States, we had a decentralized banking system. Much of it was hard money. We had free entry into the banking system. And some Western states banks were declared unconstitutional. And they, of course, there were no banks in that area. But there was considerably less inflation under the free banking system, even though wildcat unquote, than there was later on. Anyway, this is one system. And in the free banking kind of system, the hard money position, the pure gold position of the Jacksonians, and previous to that, the Jeffersonians, really, at least had a fighting chance. In other words, you have a continuing drive by the Jacksonians for outlawing banks altogether or ensuring that they pay specie immediately. One of the reasons why it's always been said that free banking leads to wildcat banking and runaway inflation. One of the reasons why there was, it didn't, but one of the reasons why there was more inflation than there would have been under a real free banking system is every time the banks got in any kind of real trouble, sort of massive trouble, brought about by their overexpansion, the government, state and federal, got them off the hook by allowing them to suspend specie payments. In other words, to stop paying their debts until this crisis is over. In the meantime, of course, they could collect the debts, they could enforce the collection of their debts, the debts to them in the courts. But while all this was going on, a moratorium was declared, so they wouldn't have to pay their own debts to their depositors, their note holders, I should say, largely. Now this great tradition of letting the banks off the hook begins in a nefarious, I don't want to deal too much with this, I don't want to go even further back as far as my back. but this nefarious tradition begins with in the War of 1812, and in order the largest center of capital investment and wealth was New England, which we all know was opposed to the War of 1812 against Britain. So in order to finance the war effort, the administration had to turn to the new banks popping up. The new banks inflated like mad. The government spends the money on munitions and so forth and manufactured goods produced in New England. The New England banks call upon the new banks of Pennsylvania and Kentucky, etc., for redemption. They ain't got the money. They ain't got the gold. So they have to go bankrupt. This is to end the modern banking system, so to speak, the origins of it. And the federal government says, okay, we suspend specie payments. This is the black month of August 1814 happened. Not only did this continue for the duration of the war, but it went on from then on until early 1817. So that for 2.5 years, the banks were let off the hook. There were two ways out. I don't want to go into detail on this, but there were two ways out faced at the time by the congressmen and theoreticians. One way was to get rid of the banks, the fractional, you know, the banks who couldn't pay, the bankrupt banks, and go back to a gold system, or gold-silver system, I should say. And the other was to set up a new bank in the United States, which would inflate enough to keep these banks afloat, which was the solution that was adopted. At any rate, but after the bank, second bank in the United States was eliminated, we have a free banking system, but hard money is a viable trend, let's say. After the Civil War, the whole condition changed, the whole system changes with two things. One, the greenbacks, which are, you know, fiat money, not redeemable in gold or silver, and it took them 14 more years to get rid of the greenbacks, to get the greenbacks back on a gold basis. And the National Banking Act, which, one, outlawed state banknotes, there was banknotes produced by state banks, outlawing by imposing an extra tax of 10% on state banknotes, and setting up a whole new national banking system with reserve requirements, etc., deliberately centralized in Wall Street, the national banks of Wall Street, and then pyramiding on top of that, smaller city banks having deposits in the central in the Wall Street banks, and the rural banks having deposits in the smaller city banks. So it's kind of a permanent expanded credit kind of system based on the central Wall Street banks as the major reserve, central reserve cities. And their reserves, their money supply they were allowed to issue was based in turn upon government, federal government bonds. It's a very peculiar kind of system. In other words, the more government bonds they bought, the more credit they could issue. So this was a system which didn't satisfy really anybody too well. For one thing, and so they looked around for reform. It was very difficult at this point to go back to. First of all, it took them, as I said, 14 years to get back to gold, even to get back to a gold standard. So this sort of exhausted the hard money people. Besides, the hard money people sort of dying out by this time. And it becomes very, to go back to the free banking system before the Civil War would have made it, you know, titanic revolutionary kind of change in the system, which the whatever gold bugs were left were not in the position to, you know, to try to accomplish. So with this sort of alternative kind of dead and defunct or forgotten, increasingly forgotten by the general public, by economists, by bankers, the next alternative looming up was a fully centralized banking system with the Federal Reserve, with the imitation of the Bank of England, which pioneered in this thing, and so forth. Now, most of us think, looking back, most textbooks think of, say, the central bank is extremely important. We must have a central bank in order to restrict the banks, the commercial banks, from expanding credit and inflating the credit excessively. This is the usual way in which this kind of thing is sold to the general public. You should be no surprise by this time that this is sort of, again, an Orwellian system in reverse. This is not the way this is not the arguments of the bankers themselves and the economists themselves promoting it used for the Federal Reserve System. The argument was, this darn national banking system is too inelastic. The money supply is, quote, inelastic, unquote. In other words, we ain't got enough of it. The banks are not allowed to expand credit enough, especially during recessions. So we need some kind of instrument to ensure more and better inflation, more and better expansion of money and bank credit. There were several problems. One was we need what Walter Badgett, the Mephistophelian figure, who was the theoretician of the Bank of England in the 19th century. So the central bank has one very important function to be a lender of what he called a lender of last resort. Lender of last resort meaning that always should be a government sponsored bank out there as a sort of a deus ex machina to bail out any bank that's really getting into trouble. So every bank knows deep in its heart there's always a central bank there to bail it out, to lend it money and so forth, to tide it over any kind of real emergency. This was accepted as a brilliant stroke, master stroke in banking theory. And then they felt it was necessary also, as Coco points out here, under the national banking system, decentralization was popping up. The Chicago banks now were becoming part of the Central Reserve, and the more and more state banks. In other words, you had less and less centralization. It was felt by the large bankers. You had to re-centralize again and impose, you know, a central control, which seemed to be getting out of hand. Also, we had the growth of the Bank of America, a state bank, which is completely outside the establishment in those days. So we had, in this situation, Once again, the economists have punked out. In other words, the economists, which previously to this period had been hard money people, and they had also been gold bugs to one extent or another. By this time, the old hard money economists had dropped out and had died off. And then it was just a question of sort of jockeying with which kind of central bank should we have. And we accepted almost on every hand that we have to imitate advanced countries like England and Germany, etc., and have our own central bank. And there's a whole litany here, which I need not repeat, that Coco mentions, all the guys who were pushing for this, for some kind of Federal Reserve Bank. And there's all sorts of jockeying back and forth. I don't think there's, in the long run, they're very important. The point is, almost everybody had one of their own kind of central bank, and we wind up with something. Some of the key figures, again, in this, the famous Jekyll Island conference, which figured in Westbrook Pegler's demonology from then on, till the day he died. One of the things which was one of the sources for writing the Federal Reserve System. At this conference were Paul Warburg from QMOA, Frank Vanderlip of National City Bank, who becomes very important throughout this thing as a great theoretician of inflation. Henry P. Davison, a Morgan partner, Charles Norton of the First National Bank, and of course Milton Aldrich. And anyway, with all this jockeying back and forth, we wind up with the Federal Reserve System. Before I get to the essence of what happens there for the Federal Reserve System, I want to mention a few words about the man whom I'll return to later lectures. The man who becomes the virtual king of the Federal Reserve System until the day he died. Not exclusively at the beginning, but enough to establish working control. By the mid-20s, the early 20s, he has absolute control until he dies at the end of 1928. Benjamin Strong, governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And it was all during the 20s, by the way, there's a constant battle between the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, which one would have thought would be the head of the system, and Strong, who was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Strong wins out. He's envisioned having a lot of clout and being in New York and buying and selling bonds and all the rest of it, close to the source. He also had a lot of political and economic clout, in addition to being a charismatic figure. I don't think we should, usually historians interpret Strong's ascendancy in the Federal Reserve System to his charisma. You should probably know by now that I don't find charisma a sufficient explanation. Who was Benjamin Strong? First of all, he had been head of Bankers Trust Company, which was a Morgan Trust Company, which had been set up a few years, 1903. Second of all, his closest friends in the world, and I mean not only business friends and people who had pushed him all along the way, but also social friends and golf club pals and all the rest of it, were Henry P. Davison, Morgan partner, and Dwight Morrow, Morgan partner. Strong, when he got the call to be head of the Federal Reserve System, he's also an old pal of Elihu Root, just to sort of cement the whole thing, and Thomas W. Lamont, another Morgan partner. At any rate, comes the call from the Wilson administration to appoint Benjamin Strong as head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He sort of hangs back in a shy and modest manner. It's finally on the road, really competent to do this. He was pleaded with and so forth and so on by Davison and Morrow to accept the post. Okay, so our hypothesis from now on, which we will test as we go along, is that Benjamin Strong was essentially, parenthesis Morgan.
Okay.
Essence of the Federal Reserve System. Here I refer to a great book, which is published by Macmillan, published by several distinguished co-authors, the senior author of whom was one of the most distinguished banking theoreticians of the 20th century, Charles A. Phillips. Yet it was a book published in the 30s by Macmillan, a distinguished publishing company, yet the book bombed totally. I mean, it was never heard from again, either by economists or by anybody else. Yet it's one of the best books on this whole period, starting both theoretically and empirically, starting with 1914, continuing on down through the 20s and the early 30s. So I refer you to this for further elucidation of this whole thing, plus other books in my bibliography. Banking in a Business Cycle by Felix McManus and Milton. What do we do here? We have a situation, this way. Supposing we have a bunch, you start off with a bunch, let's say, of independent banks. Forget a minute about the national bank permitting. That makes it just more complicated. We have a bunch of independent banks, each of which are required. The average reserve requirement before the Federal Reserve Act, the average reserve requirement was 10%. In other words, the banks could pyramid, national bank notes could issue notes, and national banks could issue notes. They could pyramid notes and deposits 10 to 1 on top of their reserves, which were either gold or government bonds or other banks, depending on where they stand on the pyramid. Let's say they're gold, again, to simplify it. So we have a 10 to 1 on top of this. Excuse me, it wasn't 10%, it was 20%. I'm giving away the punchline here. 20%, it was 5 to 1 pyramid. So these banks are allowed, and the average is, was really 21, but I'll make it 20 to make it simpler. We have allowed a 5 to 1 permitting by each bank. Okay, we centralize reserve, we take all the government forces, well, not for induces and cousins in many other ways, gets the bank to yield most of their reserves to the Federal Reserve Bank, and then we create the Federal Reserve Bank. Let's say they get all the reserves, and now the Federal Reserve Bank, the reserves of the national banks become the deposits with the Federal Reserve Bank, checking accounts, so to speak, with the Federal Reserve Bank. So now we have the gold centralized in the Federal Reserve Bank. Incidentally, this is one of the arguments that's constantly being used. Not only because the national banking system is too inelastic, in other words, not enough money, not inflationist enough, but also we need centralization of reserves. So we economize on reserves was the slogan. What this meant, economizing on reserves, was here we have, if they just put reserves into the central sort of bin here, we still have a 20 to 1, a 5 to 1 setup, 5 to 1 ratio. However, now we have the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Reserve Banks themselves, are allowed to expand 3 to 1, 35%. So let's say 3 to 1. 3 to 1 on top of their gold. So now, in other words, the gold, let's say the amount of gold centralized is the same. Now the Federal Reserve Banks are allowed to expand 3 to 1 on top of that. So this means that by this process of centralizing and having this 35% limit, we have an allowed 3-to-1 expansion of money and credit. That was the bank credit supply can go up by 3-to-1, permitted to go up by 3-to-1. And usually in banking history, if the government permits banks to expand money on top of reserves, they'll do it, except in deep depressions when they can't find anybody to lend money to because they might go bankrupt. But generally, this is it, either immediately or in a couple of years. They permitted 3-to-1 expansion reserves, they can expand 3-to-1. So this allows for a 3-to-1 expansion of bank credit, of money in bank credit. In addition to that, as if this weren't enough, this engineered inflationary potential of 3-to-1, by inflation, by the way, I mean an increase in money supply, supply of money in bank deposits. In addition to that, the Federal Reserve Act reduced the average reserve requirements by statute in half, from 21% to 10%. And actually, it was 11% in 1914 and 10% later, but basically, it was reducing it half from approximately 20% to approximately 10%, which means that instead of, before you could permit, the banks could permit 5-to-1 on top of reserves, now they could permit 10-to-1 on top of reserves. We now have an extra twofold inflation on top of a threefold by the centralization process. The mechanism of the Federal Reserve Act immediately ensures a potential 6-to-1 inflation on top of the previous supply of money. It's an enormous inflationary engine sold to the public, sold to the general public to deluded college students ever since as a restriction on inflation, as a way of combating these evil commercial banks, the private banks are out there inflating. We need this Federal Reserve System to hold them in. Actually, just the other way around, the bankers needed it to push them along. Now, this 6-to-1 potential was limited. It starts off fortuitously at the end of 1913, so it was just about in time for the war effort. Only a couple of years were into the war effort. This 6-to-1 potential was limited by money in circulation by the public. In fact, the public could take some money out once in a while. Now, this is a limiting factor. It's always a limiting factor in bank credit inflation. If all of us, for example, if the entire country suddenly cashed in their bank deposit tomorrow, it would be an excellent. This would be, you know, if I were asked to give advice to the general public, how can we stop inflation? I wouldn't say don't eat meat. I'd say cash in your bank deposits. It'd be very effective, if a little disturbing way of limiting inflation. Get your money out of the banks. Also, the 35% was, it was 40% against Federal Reserve notes. Anyway, these are minor considerations. The other problem is that there's a disturbing potential. We're still on the gold standard. There's still a disturbing potential that the public might cash in all this stuff, not only the Federal Reserve notes and the national banks deposit for gold. This could wreck the whole thing. So a big campaign is launched by the Federal Reserve System in various ways to get the public not to use gold anymore, to reduce gold to the sort of thing, gold coins, particularly the sort of thing that you give to the kids on Christmas, you know, like one gold coin. Here's your gold dollar, you're going to find all these kids. To reduce it to this sort of ceremonial status. One of the things they did is to stop issuing gold certificates and replacing gold certificates. Now, gold certificates had been issued by the Treasury. They were 100% backed by gold, so they were extremely sound and hard, et cetera, et cetera. These were replaced by Federal Reserve notes, which were backed, 40%, like 2.5 to 1 on top of gold, and which then replaced as a general cash in circulation, ousted. Gold certificates were retired and replaced by these Federal Reserve notes. Now, incidentally, one of the ways by which how does the government get its power over the commercial banks? How does it ensure the Federal Reserve has all this power to regulate, control, and inflate together? Basically, two ways. One is all the national banks were forced to become members of the Federal Reserve System. But more important than that, the state banks were not. But more important than that, the real guts, the real heart of the Federal Reserve control was. The Federal Reserve now had a monopoly in the issuance of cash, the issuance of paper money. Before that, as I said, the national banks, the private national banks like Chase National Bank, could issue their own banknotes. Now this was prohibited. It becomes illegal on the pain of death, torture, and whatever for any private bank to issue a banknote. Only the Federal Reserve banks can do that. So this means that if you want to get your money from the Chase or Chem Bank or whatever, the Chem Bank has to use their reserves to go to the Federal Reserve and buy cash from some Federal Reserve system. So this becomes the control. So this means that everything pyramids on top of the Federal Reserve Bank, which has the supply of cash in its mitt. As if the 6-to-1 potential weren't enough, there was another inflationary device that occurred in the Federal Reserve System. Before 1913, the same 21% requirement was levied by the federal government to time deposits as it was to demand deposits. This was changed now, and the time deposit minimum requirement was lowered first to 5% and then to 3% by 1917, which is almost zero. I mean, it's practically almost unlimited. Now, there's a whole controversy among economists about time deposits. Is it really part of the money supply? Isn't it? I contend that it is part of the money supply. For one reason is you can get your money out right away. I mean, there might be a little clause there in fine print saying the bank can wait 30 days, but if a bank ever really tried, if a savings bank trying to make you a commercial bank, trying to make you wait 30 days, they'd be bankrupt very quickly. That'd be a big run on the bank. It would have been before 1933 when the whole ball game changes with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. But at any rate, so they couldn't really do that. This is really a dead letter. And you have a situation where you can take your passbook down to the bank and get your money out. And you expect that you can do it. You think the money is there, even though, of course, you're deluded in thinking that. At any rate, so the time deposit method becomes a very interesting way. All during the World War I and during the 20s, by which the commercial banks could inflate even more than the 5-to-1, the 10-to-1, by trying to shift people from demand deposits to time deposits. Every time they did that, this could give more of an inflationary potential. The result of this titanic change in the banking system, which I say came along very fortuitously to finance the war effort and the post-World War I war effort. As far as I said, a lot of the war equipment comes after the war. We have this kind of situation develops. In 1914, this is bank deposit. I think it's only demand deposits. I should have checked on that. The source of the table is not good. Swing with the time deposit in the state. At any rate, bank deposits, total bank deposits, member banks, well, let's just say total bank deposits. In 1914, $18.6 billion. 1920, $37.7 billion. In other words, a doubling, approximately a doubling of the total money supply in the form of bank deposits. Approximately 100% increase in money supply in a six-year period, which is a heck of a lot. Say the least. Wholesale price level using 1913 is setting 1913 equal to 100. 1914 was 97. 1920, 243, which means a 2.5-fold increase in wholesale price level. Approximately 150% increase. So we have inflation of prices fueled in the classic manner by inflation of money supply. The World War I was very badly financed on any kind of conservative or sound criterion. We'll look at that. The usual conservative criterion for financing a war effort is, if you're going to finance a war effort, you should finance most of it at least by taxes, by levying taxes. Because if you don't do that, you're going to finance it by inflation, which is considered to be kind of a bad thing to do. The Napoleonic Wars, to give a kind of comparative analysis here. And England financed the Napoleonic Wars, which went on for a long, long time, of course, 63% by tax revenue, by levying taxes for this expenditure. World War I, financed 25% of its expenditures by taxes, the rest of it by inflationary debt. There are other details about what happens each couple of years, etc., but I don't really think that's necessary to go into it, because I think this is kind of the basic framework. Well, this sets the stage, let's say, for the World War I inflation and the post-war period coming on. I think there's still some time to run a little bit, at least, to another aspect of progressivism, which is very important, which has been alluded to here and there, the local progressivism, or municipal, or urban, city, local progressivism. Here I refer you to the justly classic article by Samuel Hayes called The Politics of Reform and Municipal Government, The Progressive Era, which has been anthologized all over the place, and several other things which I will mention. What you have here, and this is alluded to, I think Forrest was alluded to Lindsay, the essence of John Lindsay, and I really think it fits in beautifully in this whole setup. What you have, basically, is a great drive for an urban reform, really to smash and this runs through the whole setup, to smash the power of the local ward healer machine-type politicians, the old politics, you know, smash their power and to replace this power by new technician, expert, upper-class, centralized government. As compared to the older politics, which is essentially decentralized, ward-oriented, neighborhood, community-controlled, as we call it now, kind of setup. Replace this by out-of-politics, taking municipal government out of politics and into this new, great new, into the light, into the levitated light. The essence of this, before getting into any details on this, not only, incidentally, in addition to being an economic determinist, which I proclaim, I'm also an ethnic determinist, or the two of them often, of course, jibe. What you have here, and during this whole period, of course, one of the things that you have is this massive immigration from southern and eastern Europe. And as Forrest has mentioned, the original native people, the wasps who had been here are kind of scared by this whole setup, by this new invasion, so to speak. And in many aspects of life, and I'll be getting later on, probably undoubtedly tomorrow night, the public school revisionism, which is also part of a great new thing which has popped up in the last couple of years, public school revisionism in the progressive period. All these things mesh in. The whole thing is an attempt to take urban politics out of the hands of these new immigrant groups, old immigrant groups, Irish, Italian, Jewish, etc., to take it out of their hands and into the hands of the upper class WASP establishment, so to speak. And one of the things which were one of the bases, I'm going to get to prohibition tomorrow night too. Is that one of the bases, one of the key bases of neighborhood control by the local ward healer politicians was the saloon. The neighborhood saloon was sort of a key social center. One thing is the Catholic immigrants drank a lot, at least in contrast to the Protestants, who drank hardly at all, at least in public or publicly. This whole thing about drinking, which comes all the way back, I guess, at least to the 19th century, and probably before that. At any rate, this whole thing about drinking, and the Catholics usually drank, and also Germans drank, I guess, in general. I suppose German Protestants also. So you have the whole thing about, hey, these evil Germans, evil Irish, evil Italians, and they're drinking. And here you have the WASPs who don't drink, at least supposedly don't drink. And fortuitously, and along with this, you have the neighborhood saloon, and the saloon keeper is being the key ward politician. They go to him for favors, and he's sort of the beloved figure, and they all say, hi, Joe, and that sort of stuff. He often gets elected to the Board of Aldermen. And so part of the idea of smashing the local neighborhood is the idea of smashing the saloon and the brewery industry, which anyway is in the hands of the evil Germans to begin with, so you can bust them along with the local saloon keeper or something, added grace. So all these things that are happening together, it's really almost like a systemic kind of approach on every level, social and settlement house level, and the city commissioner government concept which comes in, and the city manager concept which comes in, and prohibition which comes in. And see, I regard prohibition as really also part of this whole corporatist framework, and the public school, tightening up of the public school thing which comes in, and crushing the immigrant which also comes in this period. A part of this, I was very interested. I was talking to Religio after Forrest's talk this morning, because he mentioned the whorehouse question, and it seemed to me he and I had a flash of insight, creative flash of insight in this whole thing, because in addition to the saloon, which was even more important than the whorehouse, but also the whorehouses were kind of a neighborhood ethnic. Old politics kind of setup. And I had thought that my analysis of the Mann Act, and here I feel there's a correction, I'll deal with this more tomorrow night, correction of my revered mentor, H.L. Mencken, in this whole period. H.L. Mencken, for example, saw the Mann Act and prohibition as a purely morality thing, with what he called cow country Baptists and Protestants rising up from there. From their ranches and dung heaps or whatever to impose these morality laws on their betters, on the urban folk. In this context, of course, Mencken defined Puritanism, and one of the great definitions of Puritanism of our epoch, which is Puritanism is the haunting fear that somebody somewhere might be happy. But I think more, and also I think he had essentially an economic analysis of that too. What he said about the Mann Act was that, well, this is a form of an agrarian farmer Methodist Baptist imposition, because what the farmers are saying is they don't have the money, you see, to transport women across state lines for immoral purposes. They haven't got the cars or whatever they and the dough. And their immoral purposes are intrastate. They're on the farm. So the Mann Act becomes a farmer's smashing of urban, wealthier and more affluent and more cosmopolite and more mobile urban types. In addition to that, he also had an economic analysis of the farmer and prohibition. What he said was that the urban person has to buy his liquor from somewhere. This is, interstate and so forth and so on. It's visible and can be outlawed. The farmer makes his own moonshine. He can never really outlaw that very successfully. So we're out there in the backyard. So here again, you have this sort of farm orientation. But I think there's more to it than that. It's not just the farmer. It's also, for various reasons, our centralizers, again, our corporate reform types, moving in an alliance, obviously, with the former Methodist Baptist ideologists, so to speak, moving in for their own purposes to smash the saloon, to smash the brewers, smash the evil German conspiracy. Certainly during World War I, and Leonard Ligio has done more research on this than I had, during World War I, there's a whole thing, not only about this hysteria by George Creel, etc., but the German conspiracy. Is also the German conspiracy is part of the brewing industry in general was part of the German International Kaiser conspiracy. The very act of drinking beer is a sign of loyalty to the Kaiser, and therefore you're stamping it out as part of a patriotic war effort. Of course, Prohibition really comes in during World War One. Since I was started with Prohibition, let me do the Prohibition thing. Then I was going to do the Samuel Hayes thing. This is somehow we've gotten more into this. Now, here I refer you to the James Timberlake's work on Prohibition, the Progressive Movement. What you had in Prohibition, and presumably also in the Mann Act thing. In the Prohibition, we have an alliance of forces. What Megan always referred to as the uplift. William Graham Summer referred to the uplift. That was the idea that you out there should be uplifted. If you don't like to be uplifted, you don't like the idea of being freed of the curse of demon John Barleycorn, you're going to jolly well be compulsorily uplifted. this idea, of course, William Graham Sumner in his great essay on what social classes owe to each other, his concept of the forgotten man, I think, is a definitive statement on this. His description of moral uplift was that A and B put their heads together to decide what C should be made to do for D. And in the Prohibition case, it works something like this. A and B are our reformers, our moral uplifters. They get their heads together and they say, liquor is evil, and you have more accidents and all that sort of stuff, and people get liver ailments, etc. Therefore, because a lot of people become alcoholic, therefore we should outlaw liquor. So the essence of this is that A and B, who don't drink anyway, are forcing C, who's the forgotten man, he's the poor schnook who takes a drink once in a while, depriving him of liquor in order to save D, the minority, small minority of alcoholics or potential alcoholics. So he goes on from there to say, well, what happens is A and B, of course, you pass the Prohibition law, whatever other similar legislation, and A and B, of course, are very happy. They don't drink anyway, and they're imposing their moral standards on everybody else, so they're in great shape. D, the potential alcoholic, can get the liquor anyway. I mean, he knows all sorts of sources. You knock on the window three times, and Joe's sent me, and he gets his liquor. So he gets his liver ailment, dies on the water anyway. So the person who's really harmed by this is the poor schnook C, the forgotten man, the poor humble average American, middle America, as we might call it, who likes to drink once in a while and doesn't know the illegal sources, doesn't know how to the speakeasy or whatever, and he's the one who's not being helped anyway, even in terms of reformers. He's the one who gets shafted by this whole system. Anyway, we have the moral uplifters. We have the particularly led, incidentally, we think again of prohibitionists. We think of prohibition as being sort of a right-wing fundamentalist thing. I mean, especially in these days, the Prohibition Party is sort of a right-wing prohibitionist party. In those days, it was very different. Because we have, for example, the social gospel movement, which everybody knows is the great left-wing, in quotes, of the Protestant movement, bringing the message, applying the message of Christianity to social affairs. It's almost always socialistic in nature. These guys were very hep on prohibition, outlawing the liquor industry. This is part of the social gospel. Walter Rauschenbusch, in his great work, Christianizing the Social Order, I told Leonard I was going to talk about Christian America. In 1912, Walter Rauschenbusch is again held up by any old discussions of the social gospel as being the big theoretician of left-wing Protestantism of this period. Walter Rauschenbusch in Christianizing Social Order writes that the liquor industry, quote, is seeking to fasten on an angry people a relic of barbarism. That's liquor. Who you win. Seeking to fasten on an angry people a relic of barbarism which the awakened conscience and the scientific intellect of the world are combining to condemn. Now here's the key phrase. It's this great alliance, you see, of the awakened conscience. That's the fundamentalist crazy, so to speak. That's the moral argument against liquor, combined with a scientific intellect. And this is the new scientific technicians, because the scientific technicians, while all this was taking place, were also in favor of prohibition, using scientific arguments, using statistics. Either more alcoholics die in the gutter, or more alcoholics get blind. And you can say statistically it's very true. More alcoholics have cirrhosis of the liver. More alcoholics, well, there's no automobiles much in those days. More alcoholics have automobile accidents, and on. More alcoholics go crazy and so forth. And so here we have the scientific reformer, our expert, our technician, our social worker, our social scientist, combined with the social gospel. We have this magnificent fusion of Christian theology and science. I mean, what could be more powerful than that? The Reverend Josiah Strong, for example, another eminent social gospeler, in 1909, writes that industrial work, they're coping with the industrial system. They came to the conclusion industrial work increased one's desire for alcohol. Presumably what they mean by this is you work, you know, 8 hours or 10 hours or something in the assembly line, you're kind of tired, you like to have a drink. And so he says, so it's very important to, in order to stop, you know, in order to stop urban congestion, you know, and the shame of the cities and all that, this leads, industrial work leads to further congestion. What you have to do what happens to them is they get high wages. Unfortunately, they're congested, they're tired after a hard day's work in the assembly line, and they have, unfortunately, have high wages. This is very interesting for a left-wing social gospeler. And their high wages lead them to be a little more affluent, and so they're led then, quote, to buy drink and acquire the liquor habit before they had developed a more refined taste of a higher civilization. So obviously what the conclusion for this is, you stop them, you outlaw the liquor, you refine them up. It's sort of like, this is Galbraith in the ministerial court. You refine them upward, and maybe after that you can, you know, maybe after several centuries you can allow them to drink, even though, of course, they wouldn't want to drink by that point. And in 1940, and then pushing for prohibition, Reverend Strong, of course, also. The Gospel of the Kingdom magazine writes in 1914, hailing this great drive toward prohibition, which is spreading through the states and now, you know, it's obviously looming up for the federal government. The Gospel of the Kingdom magazine writes, quote, personal liberty, and they say this with, you know, in other words, in quotes, with obviously deep contempt. Personal liberty, they say, is at last an uncrowned, dethroned king, with no one to do him reverence. Dot, dot, dot. We are no longer frightened by that ancient bogey, paternalism in government. We affirm boldly it is the business of government to be just that, paternal. Nothing human can be foreign to a true government. I like that. It's a certain ring to it. Now, one of the problems is, perhaps fortuitously, that, of course, as I say, Catholics tend to drink in at least moderate amounts, and we have this. Part of this whole thing was an anti-Catholic drive. The Catholics were not shaping up in this great drive towards purity and temperance. Catholics are largely immigrants. I mean, this is largely true. So in addition to the uplift in the Gospel of the Kingdom magazine, Walter Rauschenbusch, Reverend Josiah Strong, and some of my other favorites, we have the scientific argument. The uplift argument, the harmful effects of alcohol leads to crime, to poverty, etc., etc. Interestingly enough, we have this interesting twist. I wonder how some of these, our current social workers would sort of cotton to this. They had this kind of an attitude, the scientific social worker types. They said, man is determined by his environment. If a person is poor, and he's unhappy, and so forth and so on, it's not because he doesn't have a job or whatever, it's not because he's personally at fault. That's an ancient reactionary 19th century laissez-faire attitude. That's his personal character that is at fault. No, no, it's his environment that is at fault. All right, so it's his environment. He is determined by his environment. He's a poor puppet creature of the environment. So the way to help him out, the way to cure his poverty and his slum conditions and his unemployment, et cetera, is to change the environment. What's the environment? The environment's liquor. The saloon, the neighborhood saloon, standing there with evil temptation, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, the way to help his environment, to outlaw the saloon, outlaw liquor, so forth. All the progressive social scientists, our beloved friends from our other meetings here, Edward A. Ross, one of the great founders of scientific sociology, Simon Nelson Patton, the progressive economist, Irving Fisher, now beloved and then beloved, a compulsory vegetarian as well as compulsory prohibitionist, all these people pushing the idea of outlawing liquor as part of this great new social science, is applying the lessons of social science to the public. And the social workers, as I said, going on very neatly with this. There's also, in addition to this, interestingly enough, I've already talked about religious or religio-ethnic determinism and a little bit of our friends the social scientists again. We also have some economic determinism in work more directly. And that's many big businessmen. We're back to our big business friends again, who believe it was necessary for workers to be sober. There's this whole tradition, by the way, in Western civilization, probably know it, For example, in England, the mercantilists, many of the mercantilist theoreticians in England in the 17th and 18th century were constantly saying, we shouldn't have higher wages. Higher wages are bad. Why? Because if you increase wage rates, the workers will just get drunk on Monday as well as Sunday, and on Friday as well as Saturday, just won't work. And economics is known as the theory of the backward-sloping supply curve of labor, which, as far as I know, has never been substantiated. At any rate, so they just won't work. They just work less, so you may as well, you know, pay them lower wages and make them work harder. And part of this thing is, again, this is evil of drunkenness. These guys will go out there, they'll be relaxed a little bit, and this will reduce their, you know, hard work and their efficiency. So many businessmen now get to the point of favoring prohibition in order to sober the workers up. They won't have the temptation, they won't have the liquor, they'll be on the job more rapidly, and they'll be working harder and so forth and so on. Also, there'll be more safety at work. And here we have, you see, the tie-in with the workmen's compensation laws. Now that employers are liable by law for the accidents on the job, if keep liquor away from these guys, so they won't have so many accidents. This will cut down the cost of the employer. It's a beautiful reinforcement of one state isn't piling up on top of another. And we begin to have a situation where many businessmen engage in voluntary prohibition. In other words, as a condition of employment, no worker should be, first of all, drinking on the job, and many of the more far-out employers, and no worker should be drink, period, even off the job. The railroads were pioneering this great effort. The railroads had negligence laws, again, liability, special liability laws to worry about, too. So the railroads began to lay down the rule that no worker can drink either on duty or off duty, ever, period. The next step, of course, then, if you really want to enforce this with some of the employers, it is kind of expensive to do it, as well as a little bit messy, is to hire groups of agents, detectives, espionage agents, whatever, go around and see whether the guy's drinking or not. Okay, otherwise, what's the point of having the rule? And it found out, you see, when the railroads, it's true, I have to give the devil its due here, that when the railroads passed this rule, no drinking either on or off the job, there was a decline in railway accidents, no question about it. And this was sort of a model and inspiration for other employers in manufacturing. And the scientific management movement, which comes in around this period, Frederick M. Taylor, pushing the idea also, in addition to firming up the assembly line and so forth and so on, of eliminating alcohol because alcohol lowers efficiency. So you have this other aspect to the prohibition movement, and in addition to that, we have special regional kind of situations. For example, there are many dry states in the South, for example, many states which had state prohibition, still are, almost. At any rate, the businessmen in the dry states wanted to impose national prohibition so that the wet state people wouldn't have this advantage. We can impose this throughout the country. And the American business in general also wanted national prohibition in order to firm up the American labor force and be able to compete against these drunken workers abroad. This will increase increase our productivity in the in world markets. In addition to the sort of general business sympathy to prohibition, we had certain specific businesses which are even more economically determined in favor of prohibition. In other words, when economics is known as substitutes, or I wouldn't say close, it's hard to say close substitutes, but sort of substitutes. The closest we can think of to liquor, grape juice and Coca-Cola. Welsh Grape Juice Company and Coca-Cola Company push very hard for prohibition, for the outlawing of liquor. And I think it cannot be purely coincidence that they were the closest substitutes we had to liquor. The Anti-Saloon League, for example, of course, what we all know is was a major pressure group for prohibition, had a committee of industrialists on it, and many of these people were in this to push this kind of system. On the other hand, you see, there were, of course, certain businesses which were strongly anti-prohibition. The majority were probably in favor of prohibition. There were a few businesses that were opposed to prohibition. For example, obviously the brewing industry and the rest of the liquor industry, that question. And also the DuPonts, of course, who being Catholic, again, were very unsympathetic to prohibition on religious grounds. And so we had this kind of a breakdown. Labor unions tended to be in favor of prohibition, although they had a problem. For example, the brewers, their brewing brothers, would be thrown out of work. There wasn't too much distilling going on. It was mostly the liquor industry in those days was beer brewing. The labor unions, but aside from, of course, the problem about the Brewing Brothers who will be kicked out of work, labor unions also tend to be favor prohibition. Some of the arguments are kind of cute, will be reminiscent of certain current trends on the Maoist left. For example, one of the unions claimed that, many of the unions claim that alcohol, quote, dulls class consciousness, unquote, on the part of the workers. And so, in other words, alcohol is the opium of the masses. And it dulls that fighting spirit. So if you have prohibition, this means that the workers will be on a key vive and be able to fight the bosses better. Drinking, in other words, is a class enemy. The Knights of Labor, who are, I guess, there's still a remnant of them around in these days, fired organizers, any organizers who drank on the job or even off it, and excluded any liquor traffickers or liquor industry workers from membership. The railroad union, the railroad brotherhoods, the big four were all in favor of prohibition. The AFL could not take its stand because of the split, the liquor industry, etc., liquor workers, obviously. But there were many unions, however, which opposed it on other bases. They didn't like the whole idea. Some of them actually worry about personal liberty. And the loss of the saloons, especially the foreign-born workers and those, the ethnic neighborhood types, the Catholic workers, etc., who are in this thing and who are members of unions. The Socialist Party, as usual, was split somewhere down the middle between the pro-prohibitionists and the anti-prohibitionists. John Spargo was later turned, the great theoretician of the Socialist Party, later to turn up as a pro-war socialist. Wilson is one of Wilson's great pals in the war effort. He was in favor of prohibition because he considered it parasitic and inefficient in lowering productivity and so forth. Another interesting argument by Spargo in favor of prohibition was this. Okay, you guys are worried because prohibition interferes with personal liberty, but he says all legislation interferes with personal liberty. So what are you griping about? Well, most Socialist Party members are probably against prohibition. Again, the German influence, the influence of those Germans. The Germans were very heavily involved in the Socialist Party, and from the great brewing tradition, were opposed to it. But the brewer, the saloon setup. As I said, saloons were a basic local part of local control. The saloon setups were largely owned by the brewers, the brewing industry. The situation there was like Rheingold would own their saloons and Peel would own its saloons and so forth. There were an enormous number of retail outlets. They were all over the place, especially in the cities. And they had, they were closely involved. Again, the saloons, I'll get into this later tomorrow night when I talk about urban crime and ethnic problems, etc. One of the problems is that the saloons were tightly licensed. You had to get licenses and so forth and so on. In order to get the licenses and pay the taxes and all the rest of it, you had to dicker with local politicians. So there was a symbiotic relationship between local board dealing politicians and local saloons and the brewing industry, as a result of which we had so-called corruption and crime rampant. In other words, you have to, in order to get it, be in business, you have to get to the pay off the politician in order to keep the competitor out and so forth and so on. There's a whole kind of symbiosis. Also, most of these brewers, most of the saloons confronted the Sunday closing laws, which is one of the remnants of one of the elements of Puritanism here. And the saloons wanted to stay open on Sunday, which is not part of the German or Catholic tradition to have any kind of Sunday closing. In order to stay open on Sunday, they have to pay off the politicians, they won't close you down. So this whole thing was involved in this. Also, and you had to pay off the police, of course. So the whole police and local government machines were wrapped up in the whole saloon caper. And in return for the politician favoring the local saloon keeper, the saloon keeper, in addition to paying him off, had another, of course, very important function, which is to pull out the votes to re-elect the politician who was his friend. And the saloon keeper, being looked up to by the urban ethnic in the neighborhood, was able to pull out votes fairly steadily, and as far as the machine politician could estimate their votes very closely. Many of the saloon keepers became aldermen themselves or city councilmen and so forth. Another thing, of course, which increased the symbiosis with local corrupt machines, in quotes, and increases the political incentive for the upper class, lost business establishment, reforming corporatist establishment to smash the saloons. Another element here is that since the saloons were sort of not exactly illegal, but sort of quasi-illegal because of all these Sunday closing and licensing and all the rest of it anyway, along with saloons came other services, which ethnics, urban ethnic immigrants, etc., enjoy openly, let's say, which drove Baptist, Methodist wasps up the wall, namely gambling and prostitution. So the saloons became sort of centers of gambling and prostitution allied to it. So we have this whole set then of this kind of moral conflict, symbiotic with political, ethnic, and all the rest of conflict emerging in the progressive period. The Progressive Party naturally, of course, this is kind of to be deduced from our analysis, was wholeheartedly in favor of prohibition. And finally, it was the Progressive War that put prohibition over the top. I mentioned about the anti-German thing in the war, just two quotes and I'll be finished. The Anti-Saloon League writes during the war, quote, "The German brewers in this country have rendered thousands of men inefficient, thus crippling the Republic in its war on Prussian militarism." Unquote. I think it was one of the better quotes of the week. Another prohibitionist writes, quote, "We have German enemies in this country too, and that was not just abroad. And the worst of all our German enemies, the most treacherous, the most menacing, are Pabst, Schlitz, Latz, and Miller."